views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
Yes, welcome to Race Treaty. We have a kind of a different type of show today. We want to share some important information of an event that happened this past Tuesday, November 3rd. And by the way, this is the new show. We've been off air for a few weeks. Recently, this past week, there was a gathering at the United Nations. Experts on racial discrimination, who concluded that it's imperative to deconstruct on a global scale the ideological myth of a superior race and the resulting conviction of a superior culture, a.k.a. white supremacy. And this is in alignment with the decade of African descent, which seems to be picking up traction. And tonight, we're going to share the voiceover in two parts. Tonight will be part one. Next week, part two, with pending discussion thereafter. But this is a monumental airing tonight, because what you're able to see is the characters involved on the international arena on this issue of white supremacy connected to the decade of people of African descent worldwide. So today, confronting the silence, perspectives, and dialogue on structural racism against people of African descent worldwide, you will hear voices from Harry Belafonte, Muriel Fanon, France Fanon's daughter, representatives of Black Lives Matter, to which I am very grateful to see Black Lives Matter as a movement enter into the international arena under the umbrella of human rights, and all this new civil rights movement that's being lodged by the media is really a distraction and misdirection. It is about human rights, and we have a 10-year plan to eradicate, as you will hear in this broadcast. Again, we'll pick up on this next week. Enjoy. Thank you, Scotty.
So today's event is on confronting the silence of structural racism. And I believe we're going to start with a video message. Ivan Simonovic, our Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights.
Mr. Chairperson, ladies and gentlemen, it is a pleasure for me to be here today for this important and timely event on confronting the silence, perspectives, and dialogue on structural racism against people of African descent worldwide. Human Rights Office welcomes the opportunity to co-sponsor this event in the context of the International Decade for People of African Descent, along with our partners, DPI, UNESCO, the organization, International Organization of Francophonie, Unitarian Universalist Associations, Black Lives Matter, and Amnesty International USA. People of African descent worldwide are a distinct group that regrettably have over the course of history faced common challenges of racism and structural discrimination and continue to face impediments to the realization of their rights. Slavery and the slave trade are the base of the widespread and systemic manifestations of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerance that we see today against people of African descent. Racism and racial discrimination was further entrenched in colonial societies and reinforced in contemporary societies through increasing socio-economic inequalities, exclusion, marginalization, and injustice against people of African descent. I look forward to hearing your views on what can be done during this decade at the international, regional, and national levels to improve the situation of people of African descent. What more can we do to encourage states to strengthen the protection of human rights of people of African descent, particularly in terms of their adequate access to quality education, health and employment, access to justice, social and economic inclusion, poverty eradication, and political participation? Before turning the floor over to our panel members to share their views on these points, I would like us to first hear through video message from the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zeid Raad Al Hussein, who has been appointed by the UN General Assembly as coordinator of the International Decade for People of African Descent. Thank you.
Across the globe, women, men, and children of African descent struggle against racism, inequality, and injustice. This includes unequal treatment before the law. In many countries, people of African descent, particularly young men, experience alarming rates of sometimes lethal police action and are subjected to racial profiling and bias in the criminal justice system. They are more frequently incarcerated and are more likely to be subjected to harsh sentences, including the death penalty. People of African descent are also victims of hate crimes and Afrophobia. Communities of African descent are often also poor and marginalized, with higher rates of maternal mortality and limited access to economic opportunities or quality education, health services, housing, and social security. Women and girls of African descent are subject to compounded discrimination on the grounds of sex and race. This structural and institutional discrimination has deep roots in slavery and colonialism, and it is a universal concern, an appalling affront to the human rights that we stand for. And yet efforts by communities to seek redress for these violations are often ignored. We need systems that ensure equal educational employment and opportunities for all, systems that guarantee that law enforcement will be color-blind and fair. The entire United Nations system is committed to eradicating racism and racial discrimination against people of African descent in line with the program of activities for the decade, the Durban Declaration and Program of Action, and the International Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination signed 50 years ago. We must continue to partner with civil society, which is doing an invaluable work. Many women and men of African descent have made great contributions in civil rights, freedom, and the struggle for justice. Their courage in the face of oppression, their fearless persistence, their dignity, and often their grace have been an inspirational force for many, myself included. Together, we shall overcome injustice and build a more fair, more equal future. I thank you.
Good afternoon. Let me begin by acknowledging Jonathan Abadie, the NGO Committee on Human Rights and its Subcommittee on Anti-Racism, Greg Greer, the Working Group of Experts for the Decade of People of African Descent, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, and the staff, interns, and volunteers of the Unitarian Universalist Association and its office at the United Nations for organizing this event and finding our amazing speakers. Financial, logistic, and material support came from Community Church New York, Greg Greer, various UN agencies, especially OHCHR and DPI, and the Unitarian Universalist Association. I want to thank all of you here and all of you watching this broadcast. Your unprecedented interest in eliminating racism has already made an historic impact. The international community has noted your concern. We need to ensure that they keep what we discuss here in the front burner of the global human rights agenda. My name is Bruce Knotts, and it is my honor to represent the congregations, fellowships, and churches of the Canadian Unitarian Council and the Unitarian Universalist Association. Our first principle is to promote the inherent worth and dignity of everyone, everywhere. In that spirit, in June, the UUA General Assembly voted overwhelmingly in favor of supporting the Black Lives Matter movement. We have hung banners outside of our places of worship proclaiming that Black Lives Matter. Some of these banners have been vandalized and destroyed. We have repeatedly replaced them. We get hate mail telling us that all lives matter and police lives matter. Here's my response. Of course all lives matter and police lives matter. However, when the fire department comes to your neighborhood, do you send the firefighters to all the houses or to the house that's on fire? For over 500 years... Thank you. For over 500 years, the house of the people of African descent has been on fire. While some have succeeded and barriers for some have been lowered, for many, if not most, people of African descent around the world, they live in a world facing bigotry in destructive forms which deny opportunities granted to others, denial of liberty while others go free, and violence with frequency and intensity not experienced by others and which all too often ends in death. It is particularly tragic when this needless violence results in the death of children. It's not heroic when a big, burly man in a uniform throws a small teenage girl of color on the floor. All too often, the big, burly men... The big, burly men who beat, shoot, and kill black children face no consequences for their unjustified violence. When society fails to punish unjustified violence against black women, men, and children, it screams that black lives don't matter. It's this callous indifference to black lives that requires all of us to scream back our conviction that black lives do matter. The UN has declared this the decade of people of African descent. Let's use this decade to stop the ugly bigotry, violence, that is directed towards people of African descent and recognize that when this happens to black people without consequences, far more often than others, it constitutes a major structural human rights violation which demands urgent international attention and immediate action to end the destruction of individuals, families, and communities of people of African descent. So today, we hope to send the firefighters to the right house and give them the right instructions. Our goal is not to blame any member state, but rather to eliminate structural racism wherever it exists. Most of all, our mission here today and in the future is to save the lives of men, women, and children of African descent, who no less than the rest of us deserve a safe and secure life. With that, I want to introduce Harry Belafonte, who is the Goodwill Ambassador for UNICEF. He introduced us all in the most beautiful way possible to world music. Also, he has spent his life challenging and overturning racial barriers across the globe. Harry is United Nations royalty. Please welcome the first keynote speaker, Mr. Harry Belafonte.
Thank you, Mr. Knotts, for that embrace. Standing here in the United Nations is not an unusual experience, but each time the experience itself takes on new levels of importance and meaning. I first became aware of the importance of this institution because of a deep and abiding friendship that I developed with one of its most important designers, an American by the name of Eleanor Roosevelt. In my earliest years, she took kindly to me and put up with my youthful nonsense, asking her questions that she was patient enough and gracious enough to answer. And she did it by example in taking on the responsibilities of designing the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, watching her struggle and watching her greet the world at large in her space was a reward for me. It's how I got to know Africans in a way that I would otherwise never have gotten to know them. I knew them through mentors, Paul Robeson, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, Hope Frankel, many great educators here, and people who sought to mentor those of us who were quite young to lead us to a new understanding about Africa and the African diaspora. I also brought other credentials to the table. My mother is a Jamaican. She came to America driven by a sense of adventure and the fact that in America she thought that there would be opportunity and opportunities that she was not experiencing as a British subject governed by the colonial rules of the day. But she found America not quite what it had been fancied to be. She was undereducated. She came here looking for opportunity, and instead of that, she found belligerence. She found resistance. She discovered racism that took her experience to a new height. But because of her deeper spiritual being, she resisted very strongly the laws of this nation and the plights that not only African-Americans were experiencing, but those of us who were descendants of the diaspora. Her council, the council of Eleanor Roosevelt, the council of men like Paul Robeson and Dr. Du Bois, did much to shape my life and the choices that I have made to become a part of this great movement to end racism and to end classism. Because of the embrace of my mentors, it was Paul Robeson who very early on found a young group of black actors, artists aspiring to become proficient in our chosen fields. He pointed out that selecting the arts was a wise and a very rewarding thing for those of us who understood the power of the arts and how to apply it. He said, artists are the gatekeepers of truth. We are civilization's radical voice. We are humanity's moral compass. And with that rather hearty launching in describing what we were as young African Americans in the basement of a library in Harlem, I discovered my stimulus, becoming deeply involved in not only using the arts as a tool in which to bring the human family together, to bring clarity and understanding to our common humanity, but to specifically engage in spreading the word of Africa and members of the African diaspora. The songs of the Caribbean, the songs of Africa, the songs of the music that has driven much of American history, to the extent that we still struggle as a nation, righteously so, to bring democracy and a deeper humanity to our cause as a nation, is still in the mix. I think that when the Second World War was fought and the colonies of the world were pressed into service for the Allied forces, they told us about freedom and democracy and ending fascism and ending white supremacy, the Hitlerian concept of the pure Aryan race. All that was supposedly brought to an end by the mighty alliance of the Allied forces. Except that there was one serious flaw. The Allies were as guilty of racial oppression as was Hitler. And those of us who engaged in that struggle to end tyranny and dictatorships and fascism found that we had a new cause to pay attention to: the plight of Africans globally. From that time until now, not a day has been spent where I was not committed to sorting out and looking for reasonable ways in which to engage. The United Nations became a righteous place for me through Eleanor Roosevelt and all of the new African nations that were beginning to appear in great abundance. I would go to Eleanor Roosevelt's home, and in her home I'd meet the delegate from Kenya, the delegate from Tanzania, the delegate from Ethiopia, the delegate from everywhere. And I began to understand the great variety that exists among peoples of color in the diaspora. And I found great excitement in that fact, and found in it an opportunity to plunder the arts of the diaspora and use it as a platform in which to gain liberation, not just for black people, but for all of our humanity. I'm deeply honored, and I'm grateful for this opportunity to stand before this launching. And I hope the fruits of this convening will bring the diaspora close together, because I sadly tell you that as much as Africans speak to calling themselves African-Americans, most of us of color in America know little, very little about the diaspora. We don't know our Brazilian brothers and sisters. We don't know our Haitian brothers and sisters. Perhaps in title or some fleeting moment in a newspaper, but the depth of us as African descendants is not known one to the other. Through the arts, we can change that. But through the needs of the human race, the United Nations is the perfect place for us to sit and have exchanges and define our deeper humanity in settling the affairs of the cruelty of racism and classism. I thank you very much.
I told you, United Nations royalty. Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Mireille Fanon Mercedes France. She is the chairperson of the working group of the experts of people of African descent. She is determined that this decade will work to end racism once and for all. Her input into this program today has emphasized that we need to listen to grassroots leaders, and you will hear them. Please welcome Mireille Fanon.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's a real pleasure to see a lot of people here. You are here, you join us It's great. I would like thanks Mr. Ari Belafonte for your word. It's very strong statement. Thank you for that. And thank you for all of us. I would like also welcome Mrs. Samaria Rice. Thank you for joining us. And I hope as a chair of the working group, we will have the opportunity to meet you during our next country visit in US next January. Thank you for your coming. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent, I am pleased to be here with you today. As some of you may know, as recommended by the Durban Declaration and Program of Action, the Working Group was established in 2002 by the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. Its objective is to study the problems of racism based on hierarchy of race, racial discrimination, Afrophobia, xenophobia, and associated intolerance faced by people of African descent and African origin. We must thank the organizer of this meeting to question today, almost a year after the launch of the decade, the challenge faced by people of African descent all over the world should allow to give some path to answer to assigned objective to the international decade, fight racial discrimination, racial racism, xenophobia, and related intolerance. This attack on human dignity, non-discrimination resulting de facto for those who are victims, insecurity and non-equality in all spheres of their life, are elaborated because of a supposed hierarchy of race and culture and do not concern only one or other country, but the entire international community. In the context of the current globalization, the permanence of which allows such relation of domination, drew its speech in the slave trade and enslavement and refined it in the establishment of colonial yoke. Its relation of domination can be found both in social relation, international relation, institution, and minds. It extends its various form, in various form, is present everywhere and affects us all. One of the first challenges, then, is how to deconstruct on a global scale the elements that enable the construction of a collective and conscience accrediting the myth of a superior race and causing ipso facto the conviction of a superior culture. We are in agreement, at least almost, to say that the hierarchy of race is scientifically false, morally condemnable, socially unjust for all that the Afro-descendants, in addition to historical consequences they have to face, and the Africans with colonialism and economic migration or because of war, are the only ones subject to discrimination based on skin color, a biological parameter that completely escapes the control of the victim of this ostracism. The consequences of this ideological myth are innumerable. Who better than the state to bring this legitimate and just aspiration of millions of people left at the margin of the world? They are uniquely able to politically impulse at international level a reversal of this process of invisibility and inferiority. One of the first decisions would be to reactivate the Declaration on Race drafted by UNESCO in 1950. Recall that said the scientists who had gathered there. I quote, "For all practical social purpose, race is not so much a biological phenomenon as a social myth." They strongly admitted that myth of race has created an enormous amount of human and social damage. In recent years, it has taken a heavy toll in human lives and caused untold suffering. It still prevents the normal development of millions of human beings and deprives civilization of the effective cooperation of productive mind, end quote. Doing this, state in coordination with civil society, which would allow to be built the foundation from which the legacy of this terrible history could be exceeded. Then the second challenge is to accept the need to bring the historicizing of the slave trade and the role played by some firms at the first moment and at the second one by states in this business and in those of enslavement and colonialism. This historization is necessary to achieve and assume and share history and to prevent avoidance of silent effects concerning this period. This also allows to second the order of construction of races whose inaugural act was the establishment of the policy of race in the place of class, and it is one way to provide justice to the millions of people who are not longer there. Open the glass ceiling built from this false belief also allows to deconstruct the institutional invisibility continuum responsible for the situation in which are held the person of African descent and of African origin. It will be necessary to take by the horns the history, all history of our contemporary society built on this myth. It will then question the representation system, the conception deeply rooted in the collective unconscious pertaining to the historical truth and to the many realities interpreted under deforming prism. If that requires deconstructing of the assumed myth of race, we must also flush out at all level of our institutional system all text of our processes contributing to inequality and structural discrimination. All of us, member of state, member of civil society, activists, etc., strongly agree that racism is incompatible with the concept of democracy. The way through which our society have made this binomial compatible erodes the concepts and undermines the effort to effectively build democracy where there is a real applicability and effectiveness of non-discrimination, which is corollary equality. We must strengthen the protection spectrum and strain in DDPA, never reduce it. It is important to understand that the challenge of the decade, recognition, justice, and development, aimed at reducing forever the legacy of a culture of hatred, is a dynamic means to end the poisonous legacy of that history too often hidden. These three themes are important area which must be addressed comprehensively for the applicability, effectiveness, and justiciability of people of African descent and African in diaspora around the world. To conclude, I have to note that the working group has played an important role in the development of the program of activity of the International Decade for People of African Descent and continue to be a strong advocate for its implementation and get an international forum, even if we think a permanent forum would have been the adequate format and the condition of work for the elaboration of the UN Declaration for Human Rights for People of African Descent. We look forward to engaging with the broader civil society, as well as member states of the United Nations, as well as the United Nations and its agencies, funds and programs to make the decade a substantial change in the paradigm of domination and therefore a success. I thank the organizer for inviting the working group and thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Our next speaker is from Kenya, where I served as an American diplomat for 3 years. I love the country, would love to return anytime. It's Mutuma Ritari. He was appointed in 2011 as the UN Human Rights, by the Human Rights Council, as the Special Rapporteur on Contemporary Forms of Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance. In this position, he has focused on internet governance and racism and xenophobia, sports and the challenge of racism, profiling and law enforcement, the role of education in combating racism, and xenophobia and the glorification of Nazism and the threat of extremist movements, among others. Please welcome our final keynote speaker, Mutuma Ritari.
Thank you. Thank you. First, let me begin by thanking the organizers of this very important event. Let me also thank the participants who have honored us by being with us this afternoon. And of course, our keynote speaker this afternoon, Hale Belafonte, for his lifetime commitment as a voice for racial progress and equality. Ladies and gentlemen, it is an honor to be here with you today to discuss the important issue of racial profiling, which is a practice that persists around the world and continues to impair the enjoyment of fundamental rights of individuals and groups. This year, I have dedicated my report to the Human Rights Council to the issue of racial and ethnic profiling in law enforcement. My report examines the context leading to the practice of racial profiling and provides an overview of its different manifestations. It also presents different positive practices initiated towards the elimination of racial profiling and makes several recommendations. Profiling is prevalent in everyday law enforcement practices, but it is also worth highlighting that the issue also arises and is arising at the moment with regard to policies connected to national security and immigration. The manifestation of racial profiling has been observed in stop and check operations, which in some places disproportionately target minority groups. In Europe, for instance, minorities, including Roma people, suffer unequal levels of stops by the police. Similarly, people of African descent have historically and continue to be subjected to practices of racial profiling. Different patterns of racial and ethnic profiling have surfaced in recent years as states have taken measures to counter terrorism. Migrants and minority groups have been particularly susceptible to the adverse effects of these new law enforcement practices. In the context of immigration, official border crossings and hubs of transportation, such as airports, railway stations, and bus depots, have been common places where racial and ethnic profiling takes place. I am also concerned about the development of new technologies that purport to create risk profiles for specific ethnic groups. Use of this software by law enforcement agencies has generated fears that racial and ethnic profiling may become a regularized and permanent fixture of immigration and border control management systems around the world. Profiling in the administration of justice has often led to unjust and disproportionate punishment of individuals of traditionally discriminated groups, and in particular, people of African descent. This discrimination is partly enabled by high levels of discretionary powers in the administration of criminal justice systems. In some contexts, this practice has been intensified by indirect discrimination, where criminalization and harsher punishment related to certain kinds of recreational drugs have disproportionately affected minorities. Studies have identified correlations between racial status and harsher criminal sentences, and evidence from different countries around the world show that implicit biases have noticeable effects on criminal investigations. Consequently, in some places, prison populations tend to be comprised of a severely disproportionate number of persons from minority communities, which further contributes to their stigmatization. I cannot emphasize enough that racial and ethnic profiling is prohibited under international human rights law, as this practice violates multiple human rights, including the right to live free from discrimination, the right to equality before the law, the right to personal freedom and security, and the right to presumption of innocence. The International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination prohibits the use of racial profiling. The General Equality Provision of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights also covers questions of profiling, as do specific guarantees prohibiting racial discrimination related to the right to liberty and security of person, the right against arbitrary arrest or detention, and the right to liberty. Moreover, as has been noted by my colleague, The Durban Declaration and Program of Action calls upon states to enforce effective measures to eliminate profiling. The Rabat Plan of Action, which has been developed by a number of special rapporteurs of the United Nations, has also called upon states to enhance their efforts to combat negative stereotypes and discrimination aimed at individuals based on their nationality, ethnicity, religion, or beliefs. A number of states have made efforts to combat the phenomena through the adoption of laws and policies, establishment of adequate institutional frameworks such as oversight and equality bodies, and the implementation of training and awareness raising initiatives. States have begun to combat profiling, yet additional steps remain in order to effectively address this problem. In this regard, I would like to once more stress that legislative measures are central to any strategy to combat discrimination and racism by law enforcement agencies, and for this reason, I continue to encourage states that have not enacted specific legislation outlawing the use of racial and ethnic profiling to seriously consider doing so in order to fight impunity and further provide effective remedies, redress, and reparations to victims of such practices. I have recommended that states gather law enforcement data, including statistics disaggregated by ethnicity and race, which are essential in order to prove the existence and the extent of racial and ethnic profiling. Furthermore, investigative oversight bodies should have the authority to address allegations of racial and ethnic profiling and make practical recommendations for policy changes. Finally, I call for the effective regulation of discretionary powers of law enforcement personnel in order to reduce the risk of racial and ethnic profiling. There are several approaches that may be used in a complementary fashion, such as improving the quality and precision of intelligence gathering, making sure that law enforcement agents use this information in their decision-making, increasing the supervision of law enforcement officers' discretionary capacities, and enhancing civilians' understanding of their rights and responsibilities in encounters with law enforcement agents. In other words, the important role of the civil society. I thank you all and assure you of my partnership in promoting equal dignity, rights, and progress for individuals of all races, groups, and nationalities. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. We will now see a video message from Michel Jean, Secretary General of the Organisation Internationale de la Francophonie. Of course, her message will be delivered in French.
Aimé Césaire, le grand poète martiniquais, disait très justement que le racisme, la discrimination, se fonde sur une caricature de l'autre à laquelle on donne valeur d'absolu. Césaire a raison. Derrière cette caricature, il y a l'ignorance, bien sûr, mais il y a surtout un grand inconfort que vit le raciste d'abord avec lui-même et qui n'a rien à voir avec l'autre qu'il se plaît à détester. Au fait, le raciste est mal dans sa propre peau et ce malaise absolu qui le ronge, il l'exprime avec mépris, haine et violence envers l'autre. Le raciste vit un désordre mental tel qu'il n'aime pas que vous le regardiez dans les yeux, car il est démasqué. Alors, il se comporte en brut, cherche à vous humilier, à vous déposséder de cette force qui est la vôtre et qu'il craint par-dessus tout. Et il a peur de votre existence, qui le fait paniquer. Ma mère me disait d'ailleurs... N'oublie jamais, face à celui ou celle qui cherche à t'humilier en raison de ta différence, de la couleur de ta peau, que tout cela est irrationnel. Le problème, ce n'est pas toi, ni qui tu es. Le problème est celui de cette personne qui cherche à t'exclure pour des raisons qui n'ont rien à voir avec toi. Alors surtout, ne sors jamais brisé de cette expérience, aussi pénible ou désagréable soit-elle. Reste fier de qui tu es et fidèle à qui tu es. Je m'appelle Michael Jean, je suis d'Haïti, et c'est avec cette conviction que mes ancêtres ont combattu l'esclavage et se sont fièrement affranchis par eux-mêmes de 400 ans de déni total d'humanité, d'un système abject, construit sur la base de la suprématie d'une race sur une autre. Vous remarquerez qu'en Haïti, on ne détourne pas le regard. Nous aimons accueillir l'autre du simple regard. Le peuple haïtien est aussi très fier de ses racines africaines, héritage des plus précieux. Nous sommes fils et filles d'une africanité globale. J'ai été gouverneur général et commandant en chef du Canada, ma terre d'adoption, et je suis aujourd'hui secrétaire général de la Francophonie, une organisation internationale qui regroupe 80 États et gouvernements sur les 5 continents. L'Organisation internationale de la Francophonie a pour principe et pour raison d'être un humanisme intégral, basé sur le respect de la diversité culturelle comme une richesse absolue. Pour toutes ces raisons, je suis fière, et la francophonie est fière, de s'associer à l'événement d'aujourd'hui dans le cadre de la décennie internationale des personnes d'ascendance africaine. Je vous remercie.
Thank you. So we begin our panel discussion, and please note that my introductions are very short, and these people deserve much more, but I want to give time for the remarks, so short introductions. Gay McDougall is a member-elect of the Committee of the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. When you hear her remarks, you'll know how she earned this election. Please welcome Gay McDougall.
Chairperson, government delegates, activists. I'm really honored to be here today to have been asked to talk about the work of CERD in the context of this decade for African descendants. This month, the international community will recognize and celebrate the 50th anniversary of the adoption in 1965 of the UN Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. The convention is the centerpiece of the UN's efforts to rid the world of the blight of racial discrimination. It was born in the era when the world had apartheid, when there was Jim Crow racial segregation in the south of the United States, where I grew up and in the context that I grew up, and colonialism ruled in other parts of the world. Today, 177 countries have become state parties of the convention, and for the last 45 years, the convention has, committee, the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which has worked to ensure that the convention is a living document that has relevance and resonance in the lived experiences of communities across the globe. In its general recommendation number 34, adopted by CERD in 2011, on racial discrimination against people of African descent, the UN committee recognized that, and I want to quote the recommendation, recognized that racism and structural discrimination against people of African descent, rooted in the infamous regime of slavery, are evident in the situations of inequality affecting them and reflected in the following domains: their grouping together with indigenous peoples among the poorest of the poor, their low rate of participation in representation in political and institutional decision-making processes, additional difficulties that they face in access to and completion and quality of education, which results in the transmission of poverty from generation to generation. Inequality in access to the labor market and the limited social recognition and validation of their ethnic and cultural diversity. And finally, a disproportionate presence in prison populations. So the committee has recognized that it's critically important to understand the structural nature of racial discrimination, particularly in societies where racial prejudice has been endemic over many eras. It becomes self-perpetuating in the social institutions that determine economic survival and social advancement. Discrimination then takes on a life of its own, separate from anybody's current and contemporary intent. So it sort of sinks below everybody's level of consciousness. CERD has called for robust special measures and affirmative action programs to be instituted, particularly in these situations, deeply ingrained institutional structural racism, in order to short-circuit and overcome the self-serving definitions of merit that often operate within such institutions to justify the continuation of privileged positions. This key understanding of racial discrimination, of the structural nature, is really central to fashioning remedies. It is essential that states have comprehensive anti-discrimination legislation with strong enforcement agencies. Additionally, there needs to be a comprehensive approach that recognizes the importance of tackling laws and policies that may look neutral on their face, but which have negative, disparate impacts on communities that are disadvantaged by racial discrimination. So it does not matter whether or not you can prove anybody's individual intent. CERD has also recognized how the criminal justice system in multiracial societies can be seen as the instrument of the majority community's power to marginalize minority communities. For example, CERD has acknowledged how racial profiling policies authorize police to engage minority community members with little or no legal justification. Stop and frisk policies, broken windows policing practices, and aggressive policing of petty offenses can radically increase the number of contacts between minorities and police. Now, as one scholar, Devon Carabato of UCLA Law School, has concluded, in racially charged societies, the frequency of these engagements inscribe black people with as presumptively suspect. They communicate the idea that black lives do not matter and exposes them to the possibility of police violence. So CERD has called on states to take measures to prevent the use of illegal force, torture, inhumane or degrading treatment by police or other law enforcement agencies against people of African descent, especially in connection with arrest and detention, and to ensure that people of African descent are not victims of practices of racial or ethnic profiling. Sir has also passed a general recommendation on the prevention of racial discrimination in the administration of criminal justice system. And there, Sir outlines specific strategies that states can take to prevent violations of the convention and the functioning of their criminal justice systems. And since that recommendation was adopted by CERT in 2005, CERT has criticized countries on every continent, in every region of the world, for practices of law enforcement personnel which violate the rights of racial discrimination of minorities. CERT has called on states to investigate and prosecute law enforcement officers who commit racially biased acts under the cover of law enforcement, and to make those unlawful acts of police and law enforcement officials considered to be considered subject to increased penalties as aggravated offenses and as hate crimes. Additionally, CERT has called on states to ensure that victims of police abuses are afforded remedies that are effective, independent, and impartial, and also that victims receive fair and proper compensation. Finally, I would like to close with comments based on my own personal perspectives. I mean, let's be clear. In deeply divided multiracial communities, the problem is not actually one of policing methodologies, but rather the problem is racism. The problem is rooted in the explicit and implicit stereotypes of people of African descent as all being poor, not that poor is a problem in and of itself, but also of being angry and violent. If, as may be the case, there is a disproportionately high number of minorities in prison, well, that may also be taken to give the message that all minorities are in some way criminal elements. In many situations, police may feel that they have been given a mandate by the larger society to enforce and control minorities rather than to protect and serve those in minority communities. The larger context may be that patterns of poverty, patterns of racial segregated residential areas, segregated school districts, all these together have created enormous social distance between the daily lives of minority communities and others. And so when police enter minority communities, they do so with a mindset as if they're entering some kind of war zone. Chairperson, there is no question that protecting the rights of African descendants is the highest priority for this decade. But an important factor is also addressing the implicit biases that exist in the larger communities they live in. In this 21st century, it's important to see the African diaspora in terms of the contributions made throughout the world to economic, political, and social development of a new global society. African descendants have made their homes on every continent, and while there are still challenges to be overcome, the promise is that societies will flourish from there, from our contributions. So I hope that this decade will put emphasis on that perspective also. Chairperson, I want to thank you and others for this opportunity to put my views forward and to talk a bit about the work of CERB. Thank you.
This is Brother Elliot, host of Time for an Awakening, and you're listening to Black Talk Radio Network, media for the new millennium.
Welcome back to Race Treaty. We're going to continue with this the series next week, but I expected to play as far as we could, Scotty, with this recording.
Well, I chose that as a good cutoff point because I didn't want to cut off somebody else speaking, and that's right at, you know, almost at an hour, so that's why I chose to cut it off after her.
Oh, beautiful point. I think, though, I would like to just kind of play it out for this last half hour and, again, finish it up next week with commentary.
Okay, gotcha. So you wanted to keep going up until 10?
Yes, sir.
Okay, gotcha.
Tune in next week, folks.
Thank you very much. That really lays out the global perspective for us and defines the problem in a very concrete way. We now turn for a Latin American perspective. We have Cheryl Sterling, who is the Director of Black Studies Program at City College of New York. Please welcome Cheryl Sterling.
The Office of the High Commission of Human Rights and the Unitarian Universalist Association and all the entities involved in putting together today's events, and thank you all for attending. Even though Latin America and the Caribbean are often lumped together, key distinctions occur in their social and political terrains in terms of identification, stratification, and integration of Afro-descendant peoples. While Latin American countries and the Spanish-speaking Caribbean
listeners, give me just an opportunity. The video stopped for some reason. See if we can get it back going. Have no idea why.
Integration of Afro-descendant peoples. While Latin American countries and the Spanish-speaking Caribbean may have more in common because of their mestizo ideologies, the French, English, Dutch-speaking Caribbean are, for the most part, countries governed and dominated, at least population-wise, by black peoples. To understand where the Afro-descended population fit into Latin America, one must understand the ways in which the discourse of mestizaje, or race mixing, operates. Across the board, Latin countries present national ideologies of being racially mixed nations without racial or cultural discrimination. However, until recently, many of these nation-states did not recognize the Afro-Latin and indigenous populations as separate categories. For the sake of brevity, I'm going to limit my remarks to a comparative between Brazil and Jamaica. And Brazil has one of the largest economies and the largest African-descended populations in the Western world, and Jamaica, for the Caribbean, is a relatively large island. Brazil, in particular, was girded by the myth of racial democracy, which purports that everyone lives in harmony because they're all mixed. Now, while this myth has been debunked, its effects are still felt in how discrimination takes place in color-coded hierarchies. Again, however, perceptions about color are changing, as reflected in the 2010 Brazilian census. For the first time, Brazil has been identified as being having a dominant non-white population, as the number of people identifying as black and brown increased in numbers. Black rose from 6.2% to 7.6%, and the mixed population from 38.5% to 43.1%. The Human Development Index for Brazil has increased substantially, and it is now considered in the high development category. Adult literacy grew from 74.6% in 1980 to 90.4% as of 2012. Childhood literacy has also increased from 9.9 to 15.2. Access to clean drinking water, electricity, and sanitation has increased nationwide. Nonetheless, there are enduring inequities between the north and south of Brazil, which is the economic development center, and, of course, the north is considered the home of the mixed race and the black populations. That the poorest people are of African descent and that they face the highest rates of unemployment is something that has become quite a naturalized dialogue. If employed, black men tend to do manual labor and women domestic work. Relative lack of schooling and occupational training tend to keep people of African descent in these menial labor positions. There is also an overt pattern of police violence against black males, and that the police are also men of color needs further understanding and study. Brazil's black movement began in 1977 to protest these inequalities and to improve the lives of Afro-descended peoples and to push for people of color to identify as black as a source of change and empowerment. And such identification has created the change, as we see from the census. Under Lula's administration, two important positive policies were also put in place, a Bolsa Família and a policy of affirmative action in the university. The Bolsa Família gave monies to poor families to help improve education, and the quota system also was open to public universities to guarantee 50% of the spaces to black or mixed-race students. Within the last 10 years, there has been a growing class of black professionals working in more traditionally prestigious occupations, for example, lawyers, engineers, doctors, and they've entered into the mainstream economic areas such as health professions, civil service, banking, telecommunications, oil, and mineral exploration. However, as they overcome the economic hurdles, they are still subjected to social ones, such as stereotyping in the workplace, limited service or poor treatment in public spaces, and color prejudices in families that limit interracial relationships. Yet this changing racial climate allowed for the first black woman, Marina Silva, to run for president. And while largely due to her own policies she did not win, this was a marker for many in the black movement that discrimination could be overcome in the nation. Now, Jamaica is a dominant Afro-descended country, 76.3% black, 15.1% Afro-European, 3.4% East Indian and Afro-East Indian, and 3.2% white, and 1.2% Chinese, 0.8% other. And Jamaica's motto is, out of many, one people. However, even in a black nation, skin color is hierarchicalized. The elections of P.J. Patterson in 1992 and Portia Simpson Miller in 2012 marked the only two black prime ministers elected in the nation. Lighter skin color is still considered more beautiful and advantageous, and the proliferation of bleaching products and their use attest to that in the nation. Current World Bank statistics estimate that the Jamaican population is at around 2.7 population with a GDP of $14 billion. Also, an external debt of 146.5% of its GDP. Jamaica's per capita income is $5,289 per person. And unemployment is at 13.2%, with youth unemployment at 38%, and about 20% of the population at or below the poverty line. The country has very limited economic resources and is largely dependent on tourism, bauxite, and remittances from abroad. Its adult literacy rate is, however, 87%, with average years of schooling at 9.6%. Although the public education is free, getting a university education is based on meritocracy. If one is not part of an elite group of students who acquire the necessary academic training, admission is denied. Even with admission, one is not guaranteed acceptance into the faculty of choice because of limited spaces. Higher education hence becomes a tool of discrimination that guards the society's stratification because poorer and working class families do not have the means to supplement student education to gain necessary access to the university system. Jamaica's limited resources and educational modalities lead to a host of social problems, such as high employment, increased crime and violence, which disproportionately affect the majority Afro-descended population. The problems are deep-rooted, but we're also at a turning point with both Brazilians and Jamaicans, as both countries and the peoples have the socio-political knowledge and a desire to confront these challenges. Two vectors of proven change have to be implemented. One, more democratization of education, and of course, building self-sufficient economic communities from the grassroots level. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And now to continue our discussion of the Caribbean and Latin America, please welcome Ramona Hernandez, who is the director of CUNY Dominican Studies Institute and professor of sociology at the City College of New York.
Muchas gracias. Thank you. I'd like to thank Ms. Kelly Onimba for this invitation. Discrimination against black people of African descent in Latin America is historical. It goes way back to the first day black Africans were bought, sold, and brought by force by their owners to a land they knew nothing about. Enslaved African blacks entered into America Latina as a commodity whose only value consisted in their capacity and ability to produce profit to enrich others, those who owned them. Too many African blacks perished in America Latina, converted into commodity. Those who owned black people in Latin America had no intention of treating black who survived differently as equals, to integrate them into society as bona fide members. It was more. The children of blacks had no better fate. They too had a price which, as their parents, was lower than the price of white children. The future owners of black Latin American people. It is in La Española, a small island in the Caribbean, where this human devalorization of African blacks in the Americas began. The system that devalued blacks as people and valued them only as a commodity that generated the enrichment of others would spread throughout the Americas, and the Spaniard conquistadores, owners of black people, would be joined by Portuguese conquistadores, English conquistadores, French conquistadores, and Dutch conquistadores. Each of these groups would erect their own version of a social economic system that had in common a perception of black people and a way of treating them. The common perception about blacks was ideological, and as such, it permeated all institutions of society where racial inequality existed. Institutional discrimination is a structural discrimination. It is something that doesn't happen one day, that is perpetrated by one. A structured racism is ingrained in society's social fabric, in people's blood, flesh, and souls, and it is perpetrated every day, all the time, systematically, in different ways, from overt to camouflaged manifestations. And as scholar Frank Fanon demonstrated years ago, way too many blacks born within this system learn to value themselves through the system that devalued them, that considered and treated them as less. And this view, gracias. And this view of themselves made many black accomplices of their perpetrators. But oppression breeds resistance. And it is in the same island of La Española where African enslavement began in the Americas, where blacks began to resist, to fight back. They began to undermine and challenge racism on the same day racial discrimination started against them in that island. This is to say that an ideology based on an alleged inferiority of blacks did not penetrate all blacks in America Latina, did not manage to break all blacks. There were blacks who were not alienated from themselves, their history, their culture, and their legacy. Of course not. In fact, I argue that a systematic and long resistance is what explains the survival of the black African legacy today in the Dominican Republic a country that shares the island of Española with the Republic of Haiti. Dominican historiography documents that Trujillo's Hispanic white state ideology did not take a hold of Dominican society as he has expected. Trujillo's ideology confronted disdain, people who continue to do their thing despite the fact that disobeying the Iron Fist regime could cost dissenters their lives. From the 1930s to the 1950s, intellectuals and medical doctors reported to Trujillo that Dominicans were practicing black religious rites and that they were playing and dancing to the rhythms of African drums. Informants penetrated these groups incognitos. In their reports to Trujillo, the expert concluded that Dominicans were mentally ill, suffering from delusion. They also determined Dominicans were submerged in cultural ignorance. And Trujillo acted against that, all that was African black in the Dominican Republic. Dominican blackness then remained practiced behind Trujillo's back, changing from overt pride to subversive immodesty. Dissident Dominicans surreptitiously protected their black cultural legacy and secured its survival as long as Trujillo was in power. And afterwards, when Trujillo's sinister collaborator and successor, Presidente Joaquin Balaguer, took power and furthered the anti-black state policy designed by his predecessor. A way to undermine and dismantle structural racism today, an ill that persists despite monumental government legislation against it, is precisely by acknowledging that resistance, by speaking about these subversive actions on the part of black predecessors, by de-victimizing blacks and recognizing their victories, their standing up to evil social structures in societies in America Latina. My New York-born and raised son learned to be proud of himself from his grandparents, all Dominican immigrants who were also conscious of a social structure that fed all kinds of inequalities and devalued some people while overvaluing others. They had a history of clandestine resistance, a resistance and a pride that may have not been articulated in formal theoretical forms or expressed in government legislation, but that were passed to me and then to my son. The decade of the Afro-descendant should pay close attention to the history of struggle and resistance and to the history of cultural victory, endurance, and transmission. It should expand the narratives that speak of the multiple actions black undertook in their struggles to remain, to be unbroken, to keep their legacy, to be despite systematic attempts against them. The faces and the names of the protagonists of these struggles should be undusted and written in new history books that understand and portray blacks as people who may have given up and as people who never did. The history of resistance and cultural endurance is encapsulated in the traditions practiced for centuries by the average people, by the many groups that systematically went on in their marginalized and forgotten urban and rural spaces. They have been preserving their black African essence with our approval and resources provided by either the national elites or the Dominican state. It is these warriors, these agents of historical and cultural preservation, who have continued to act on their own, supported by their local communities, who, though unseen by the untrained foreign eyes, who may only see what he or she has learned to see in his or her own society, are very real to the Dominican people. The Afro-descendant decade to document this cultural resistance, to support this who without massive support and tons of money behind them had done what needs to be done to ensure that my son's black African legacy remains in him and in the future generations of his descendants once I nor him are no longer in this world. Muchas gracias.
Thank you so much. So we now move north into North America. Stephen W. Hawkins is the executive director of Amnesty International USA. His deep and personal experience in grassroots advocacy, fundraising, youth engagement, and membership mobilization empowers his fight for human rights on a global scale.
We welcome his empowering message to our program of action here today.
Thank you all, and thank you to the High Commissioner and honored guests. Amnesty International took to the streets in Ferguson and in Baltimore because we recognized the human rights crises that were unfolding here in the United States with respect to police use of force against citizens, and particularly black youth. What we recognize is that the police here in the United States are relatively ungoverned in terms of their use of force. Amnesty, as a result of being on the ground in Ferguson and Baltimore, undertook a study, a 50-state study of the laws on the books in every state within the United States. What we found was shocking. 9 states had no law codified whatsoever with respect to how the police should use lethal force in any given situation. None of the states met the standards prescribed by the international community. And as a result, we've put together some model legislation that comports with international standards, and I'm pleased to announce that Maryland and a few other states are looking at adopting law, Maryland being one of those states that had no law at all on the books, and hopefully will adopt the standards that Amnesty has put forth. What we face in terms of policing in the United States is extraordinary in terms of the fact that we have 18,000 local jurisdictions, totally atomized, totally decentralized, so that 4 deputies in some small town can determine whether someone lives or dies on any particular day. That is outrageous. And when I look at the national response to the crisis after 9/11, when we had in this country, in the United States, thousands of local airports, big ones like JFK, but also small regional airports in rural areas and so forth. But within 1 year, the federal government was able to act and create TSA and do something about this totally decentralized approach to airline security. Well, I believe that we face another crisis in this country, and that's the crisis of how black youth are treated by the police in this country. And if the federal government can respond to one crisis, it can respond to this one. And I think the families of Tamir Rice, of Eric Gardner, of Michael Brown, of Andrew Joseph, and so many others call for this government, call for the United States government to react to this crisis in the same way. Thank you.